The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I will have the honor of being the moderator for panel number 3 on the interpretation and implementation of CAT Article 22. We have a very distinguished panel with us today. I will be reading the order in which they will speak. In first place, Barbara Jackman, immigration and refugee lawyer, Jackman and Associates of Canada. Number 2, Francisco Quintana, deputy program director for the Andean, North American and Caribbean region of the Center for Justice and International Law. Number 3, Julia Hall, researcher on counterterrorism and human rights in Europe, Amnesty International. And number 4, Anne Jordan, director, program of forced labor and trafficking, Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. It's a distinguished pleasure to be here and talk about Article 22 petitions. I will just start the ball rolling by saying that it's an honor for me to be a moderator of this panel. And of course, Article 22 has become a very important piece of the work of the human rights system by which individuals can petition against states. And I think that is a remarkable advance in the human rights field when you have the possibility as an individual to do this. There are considerations we will be talking about. But fundamentally, I think it is an exercise the Committee Against Torture has done an enormous effort in being able to handle. There are very human aspects that we deal with in these considerations. And as an expert of the committee, I think it touches upon oneself when one individualizes a person and is able to identify a case in which there are torture, inhuman, cruel, or degrading treatment or punishment. So with that being said, I would like to ask our first speaker, Barbara Jackman, to take the floor, please, and begin. Thank you.
I'm going to stay at the table and talk, if that's all right, because I've got notes. I'm going to talk briefly about how you make a complaint to the Committee Against Torture and some of the considerations that go into it. And then I want to talk a bit about the difference between torture and cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment, and make a case for broadening our understanding of that kind of mistreatment. First of all, states who have ratified the Convention Against Torture can also, under Article 22 of the Convention, declare that they are prepared to have the Committee Against Torture consider individual complaints to it about persons who claim they've been tortured or subjected to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. A person is entitled, not anonymously, they must at least identify themselves, to make a complaint to the committee in that instance. I don't think the United States has ratified it, but Canada has, our country. The country I come from, we can make complaints to the committee, and there are complaints that have been made, some successfully. One of the well-known ones is Khan, where the committee decided that he shouldn't be removed from Canada. Once a person makes a complaint, first of all, there's no particular form of the complaint. There are a number of factors that have to be included so that the committee can take jurisdiction. They have to know if they're going to be able to take jurisdiction. So when you submit a complaint, you can do it in a letter form or you can sort of make your own form up. There isn't any particular form to it. But you need to at least cover the following information. You have to set out the person's name, address, age, occupation, the name of the state party that the complaint's being made against, the reason why the complaint's being made. If the person's got assistance, they should also clarify which provisions. And in these kinds of cases, often it would be Article 22, the person claims to be tortured, or Article 16, the person claims to have been subjected to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. that those provisions have been violated. You have to outline the facts of the case, and in outlining the facts, you should document it if anyone ever ends up taking these kinds of complaints up to the committee. So, for instance, if there's medical reports confirming the kind of treatment that the person claimed to have received, even if they're after the fact, they have to be after the fact. The torture doesn't usually have doctors present at the time. That should be documented. As well, because you have to exhaust domestic remedies, you can't make a complaint internationally to a treaty body like the Committee Against Torture unless the person's already gone through the court system in their own country and either exhausted it or there isn't effective remedies or the remedies that are available would take too long to access. Unreasonably delayed remedies can be considered no remedies at all. So you have to show in the complaint what steps have been taken. And so, for instance, if in Canada, if you've got a refusal to hear a case by the Supreme Court of Canada, you've exhausted remedies. You'd put that order in with your complaint because you need to give the committee the documentation to be able to substantiate what you're saying to the extent that you're able to. The committee, and then the last point that you should be making in terms of a complaint to the committee is whether or not you've made the complaint anywhere else. And this is important because there are what you call treaty bodies, bodies that have been created under conventions like the United Nations Human Rights Committee and the Committee Against Torture, where you can make a formal complaint and under a convention the committee that's been structured can consider the complaint if a state has made a declaration that they consider that they will be bound by the competence of that committee. But there are other informal, non-treaty body complaint mechanisms, which we use all the time in Canada, and I think they're very important, and they don't preclude you from bringing a formal complaint to the Committee Against Torture or the UN Human Rights Committee. So, for instance, you can complain to the Special Rapporteur on Torture, you complain to the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention about arbitrary detentions, and if you're trying to build cases, often those agencies, even if they're not formalized ones, can be helpful in terms of bringing to light wrongdoings in a particular state. That won't preclude the person from bringing a complaint under the Convention Against Torture. The other thing I think you have to think of when you make a complaint is to figure out what it is you want to complain about. If you're complaining about torture that hasn't been, that there isn't an effective remedy in the state or the person's facing deportation to a country where they believe they would be tortured, the Committee Against Torture may well be the appropriate body to go to. But in other instances, if you want to complain about fair trial rights or things like that, you might want to go to the UN Human Rights Committee, for example, or to the Inter-American Commission because you can raise more than just the torture, cruel and human degrading issues, you can raise broader issues under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So those kinds of considerations should govern how you make a complaint. From what I can see of the Committee Against Torture is that it's largely focused on facts. And I guess sort of the breakdown for us is if we think we have a really strong case on the facts, for example, in Canada, what would usually arise is the question of Canada sending someone back to face torture. If we think the facts are fairly strong on that, then lawyers in Canada have made complaints to the committee. But if we think that the person hasn't been treated fairly in the process and they face a risk of torture, we'd probably make a complaint to the committee, the UN Human Rights Committee, because then we can put everything under one umbrella in one complaint, and you can't do both. You've got to choose. So it's got to sort of govern how you think about complaints that you're making. With respect to the exhaustion of domestic remedies, again, the easiest is to actually exhaust them. So you go up to the highest court in your country, you don't get permission to proceed, or you do get permission, you lose the appeal, and that's exhaustion. But in other instances, it may be, and a lot of the cases the committee sees, it is the case that there aren't effective remedies in the state. So the person who claims to have been tortured makes a complaint to the investigating prosecutor and asks them to investigate and lay a charge against the person. They don't do anything for 3 or 4 years. That's an ineffective remedy. And in that case, you don't have to wait and wait and wait for no answer to ever come. You can go to the committee and make the complaint, but you have to show that it would be ineffective in your home state. The committee's proceedings are closed. They're not public. Once they have heard from a state, they will decide, and sometimes they may do this together, they will decide if a complaint is admissible. It's sort of like regular pleadings. You make your case, the state makes its reply, you get to reply to them. Then the committee will decide whether or not the complaint's admissible. In some instances, and I'm not quite sure, maybe Dean Grossman or someone else can explain, I don't know when they decide to hear them at the same time, but there's often cases where they will go straight from admissibility to the merits, and other cases where they will give states a further opportunity to reply once they found the matter admissible, and then you get to reply again. So it works like the normal process in terms of fair process. Once they found a complaint to be admissible, they can decide whether or not a state has breached the convention. I think in most countries it's the same as it would be in Canada, that if a person succeeds before the committee, it doesn't necessarily mean a state's going to comply with what the committee's views are. And in Canada, anyways, a democratic country, we have a big problem with it not complying, in essence, with committee's rulings. So one of the things that you can do, and that we do often with international treaty bodies, is ask for what's called interim measures. It's like an international injunction. So, for example, if we have someone being deported and we think that person would face torture in another country, you make a complaint to the committee and you say, Canada's going to remove this person before you look at the case. And the committee can ask Canada or another country not to remove while they're looking at the complaint. I took a case up to our Supreme Court of Canada on that issue. In Britain, the UK House of Lords and the Privy Council, it's actually the Privy Council, have found that in an instance where someone has a complaint under a formal treaty before an international or regional treaty body, and that body has given what's called interim measures, it would be wrong for the state to remove the person until the complaint is decided. In Canada, we had a split court all the way up to leave. We didn't get leave in the Supreme Court, but for the first time in our history, we had a split panel on the leave refusal. There was one judge who dissented, and that's been never heard of. They should have given leave. In a case that raised the same issues, and what they decided, the majority opinion in Canada, was even if you had an international remedy, and even if the committee, the treaty body, has asked for Canada to comply with interim measures and not remove the person while the complaint is pending, as a matter of fundamental justice, Canada is not required to let the person stay until the case is decided. It's something that, again, I think we would take up again if an appropriate case came up. The one thing I've learned in the many years I've practiced is that regardless of the court saying no or the committee saying no, you just keep trying. Eventually someone will see the light. And that's how case law gets changed. So I think it's important to use the committee for a number of reasons. One is because it creates a body of law that you can use domestically. The cases that I've been involved in Canada, which have raised fundamental human rights, we have used decisions and views of the committees, the Committee Against Torture, the UN Human Rights Committee. We have used the general comments of different treaty bodies. We have used reports. We've used the reports of the committee on examining Canadian practice under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention Against Torture. Those documents may be considered soft law in a sense, but they influence courts. So I think one of the key things is to use the committees to develop a strong and vibrant body of international law that assists in promoting human rights domestically, because you can certainly quote from them, and I think it's essential. What I wanted to talk about was where I see a need to strengthen the provisions. I was reviewing for the purpose of speaking here some of the recent decisions of the committee, and it's interesting, in the last annual report, There's three cases that the committee, three of the cases, I mean, they did more than three, but there was three that I sort of pulled out, where the committee addressed torture and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment. And I actually couldn't see much difference between them. In the one where the person was found to have been tortured was Sadia Ali. And in that case, she had been hit and slapped and had her clothes ripped off. And she thought she was going to die. So maybe that's the differentiating factor in it. And in the other two cases, in the Osmani case and the Karamchiev case, they had been beaten. One man had blood in his urine. They were very severe, severe beatings. And that was determined by the committee to be cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And what I take from that, first of all, is at least internationally, there isn't a clear line between the two, between what's torture and what's cruel, inhuman, and degrading. The convention defines torture. It doesn't define cruel, inhuman, and degrading. And one of the best sources, I think, for determining what's cruel, inhuman, and degrading is to look to the European Court, because they have a more developed body of law around that that's not just rooted in facts, but rooted in a deeper kind of analysis over a longer period of time. I think that there are a couple of questions that arise today in a post-9/11 world, and one of them is, do you want to broaden or expand the understanding of torture and the understanding of cruel, inhuman, or degrading, or is it better to limit them in the hopes that by limiting and having a more narrow understanding of the concepts, states will at least try and comply with those kinds of narrow ones? I don't favor the latter view. I think that the broader they are, the better, because I think that it is necessary to both identify and address expanding ways of mistreating people, which is what our states are doing now. I think the second point that's important to ask in a post-9/11 world is whether or not the committee, whether or not courts as well, are aware or sufficiently aware of forms of mistreatment that have been developed. And I want to use as an example what's happening in Canada and the United Kingdom. We don't beat people, but we subject them to cruel treatment. In Canada and the United Kingdom, the United Kingdom has what's called the control order system, where people who will not be deported are subjected to control orders on the grounds that they may be terrorists. In Canada, we have what we call a security certificate system, and it's very much patterned on the UK system, where we do pretend that at some point we will deport the person, and that's the reason why we have the system in place. In both systems, both the control order system and the security certificate system, persons are either detained or subjected to controls, severe controls, for an indefinite period of time. They are all at some point in the future subject to a threat of refoulement to their country. They are persons who would be at risk of torture. The kinds of conditions, in Canada, it's included lengthy solitary confinement. One of the persons, Omre, whose case was he just succeeded on his case, spent about 5 years in solitary confinement in Canada for nothing. At the end of the day, he just won his case, and the court recognized that there was not reasonable grounds to believe that he was a member of a terrorist organization. Now, reasonable grounds in Canada is more than possibility. So the state was unable to prove that it was possible that Omri, who they put in solitary confinement for 5 years, was involved in any way with terrorism. He wasn't. It's a very low threshold. It's the lowest you can have in Canadian law. And he was subjected to 5 years of solitary confinement, only to be... I have 2 minutes left. In any event, the problem with the systems in place in Canada and the United Kingdom, like I said, is we don't beat them. They're breaking down. I mean, I have clients that are subjected to the security certificates who have suffered mentally. In the United Kingdom, at least 5 of the people are in psychiatric institutions. It has destroyed their mental integrity. It's cruel. If you're going to destroy a person such that they're never going to come out of a psychiatric institution, it doesn't matter that you didn't hit them. It's cruel. I think what's really important is that people start to look, the committee especially, the organizations and bodies that deal with torture, start to recognize that it doesn't necessarily involve hitting someone, that there are other forms, and it doesn't necessarily involve intentional, like putting white lights or noise all the time. You can do it in other ways. And states are becoming very sophisticated. Canada and the United Kingdom, I think, lead the way in terms of doing this for people. One of the big problems with it is that they're court approved. The courts are the ones that are that have imposed these kinds of conditions. At the beginning, I mean, the recent arguments, we're waiting for a decision from one of our judges on whether or not this kind of conduct now is cruel 3 years after the fact, when a person's 24 hours under house arrest, has to have his kid or his wife with him all the time, day and night, in and out of the house, on top of 7 years of detention and the threat of deportation always hanging over his head. I mean, he's one of the people where mentally it's very much affected him. So I doubt our court will find that Canada, Canadian officials, and the court itself has engaged in cruel treatment. Our Supreme Court of Canada did not find it when we raised it before them in the Omri case, in terms of whether he'd been subjected to cruel treatment. I think somebody at some point has to come to terms with that kind of treatment, and I think it's important that it be, that if it comes before the committee, that it be broadened, that in order to prevent future forms of cruelty being imposed on people, it's important to stop it now before it develops further and becomes a standard practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. Our next speaker will be Francisco Quintana, and I leave the floor to him. He will make a presentation, I understand.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank American University and Amnesty International for this fantastic opportunity. Last night, Dean Grossman said that it was necessary, this kind of space, in order to create exchange of new ideas between academics, civil society, and members of international bodies. Today, I will talk about Article 22 with a comparative perspective between the Inter-American system and the United Nations system. The Center for Justice and International Law is a regional non-governmental organization whose mission is to achieve full implementation of international standards through the use of the Organization of American States tools for the protection of human rights and also international instruments. Our approach is a victim-centered one. This means that we are not going to take any steps that will go contrary to their interest, even if we were able to create some new jurisprudence. We work in partnership with human rights defenders and organizations. As an effort to integrate international standards on torture, CEHIL worked in conjunction with APT in the publication of a guide that will help to ensure that international and regional legal norms for the prevention of torture and other treatment are universally respected and implemented. Professor Juan Mendez made reference to this instrument before. As a first step, we introduced and promoted standards, and we didn't focus on the implementation of Article 22 petitions. Literature in this particular point is scarce, and the few books that make reference to this Article 22 petition system limit to the establishment of the requirements. My presentation will be basically comparative, trying to decide which is the best organ where we can present a petition. This is a scenario that we face in our work all the time. Some of the questions that we have to face is how long the procedure will last, how much knowledge of the region, the country, has the international body, or if the jurisprudence is sufficient in that international body, and finally, which kind of reparations are granted by the particular case. As we analyze these complex issues, we will make reference to Article 22 and the correspondent articles of the Inter-American Convention. I will focus mostly in Latin America because that's where the Inter-American system has the most impact. As Barbara mentioned, in Canada, there have been many cases brought before the Commission, 68 cases have been registered. I will not address Canada because Canada is not party to the Inter-American Convention and is not party to the Inter-American Convention to Prevent and Punish Torture. Nonetheless, there is an interesting information. Canada is the third country on the list with cases before the United Nations Committee on Against Torture. Under the international instrument, petitions are regulated in Article 22, and also some of the clarifications of the procedure are established in its rules. On the contrary, in the Inter-American system, the American Convention on Human Rights establishes in several articles the procedure for the processing of a petition. First of all, as Barbara mentioned, in the Commission, in the international body, a petition can be presented without any formalities. This is also true for the Inter-American system, where even the protection is broader, because a petition can be presented by any person, any organization, or any international human rights organization registered in the member states. Article 22 requires an express consent in order for individuals to present a petition. In the Inter-American system, all parties that have ratified the American Convention can present or are subject to the jurisdiction of the Commission. This is not true for the court, where, similar to Article 22, there is a necessary declaration. The admissibility requirements, paragraph 5 of Article 22, establishes that domestic remedies have to be exhausted. This is almost true for any international body that receives individual complaints. But here we can find two main differences. In the UN Convention, there is only express mentioning for exceptions to this rule when remedies are unreasonably prolonged or it is unlikely to bring effective relief to the person whom is the victim. In contrast, in the Inter-American system, Article 26 goes in a much broader definition, and also exceptions to this rule are broader. Jurisprudence, both from the Commission and the Court, have expanded these exceptions and the jurisprudence on this domestic remedy rule. Barbara also mentioned that some of the requirements to present a petition were the name, the address, the age. This is expressly mentioned also in the Inter-American system instrument, but here I notice a difference. The Inter-American Convention expressly mentions the requisites that a petition has to fulfill. As the international instrument, you will have to refer to Rule 99 of the procedure in order to have clearly stated which are the requisites that the Secretariat will review. And this Rule 99 expresses that the Secretariat will request in a second part of the procedure, when they are reviewing the petition, any lack of these compliances. Another requirement for admissibility will be that the petition has not been presented to another international procedure. In the Inter-American system, there is a time limitation in order to present a case. The case has to be presented 6 months after the final notification of the remedy, when it has been exhausted. In case of the committee, this rule applies only when the domestic remedy has been unreasonably prolonged as to render considerations of the claims on duty difficult by the committee of the state party. Some of the grounds for admissibility in both bodies are the unanimous application. This could be a ground for admissibility before the torture committee, and the abuse of the rights of the submission. In contrast, in the Inter-American system, there is a lack of compliance with Article 46 requirement, lacks of facts, or the petition is groundless or obviously out of order. The definition of the abuse of rights has been stated in the UN committee as containing the following conditions. The submission of the matter to the committee must amount to a malice or a display of bad faith or intent at least to mislead, or be frivolous, or the acts or omissions referred to must have nothing to do with the convention. This was stated in a case in 2005. against Tunisia. And some other aspects. Dealing with torture, there is a time requisite for written explanation by states, something that will seem a very long period of time because of the nature of the crimes that the committee is looking at. Paragraph 3 of Article 22 establishes a 6-month period for the state to present written observations. In the intermittent system, there are no time limits, but even when you present a case, there is a 2 to 4 month procedure in every stage. The Commission will request parties their written observations and will give 2 to 4 months in order to submit these observations. Nonetheless, there is a huge backlog in the Inter-American system that will delay initial petitions up to 2 years for the Commission to take a decision in order to request information on the state. So the rule of the 6 months in the international body is not that long if we analyze the backlog of the Commission. As Barbara mentioned, there are some stages at the international body which are more clearly defined in the Inter-American system. And the Inter-American system, you have the admissibility stage, the merits stage, and also some compliance. Something that is not in the universal body is the friendly settlement procedure. That Inter-American system has proven, at the Inter-American system, this friendly settlement procedure has proven to be really effective. And something that I wanted to mention, I'm going to go a little bit faster, is the impact of the UN committee in Latin America. As I mentioned, I'm not going to address Canada. As you can see here on this presentation, let me see. Only 12 states in Latin America have accepted Article 22, or have presented Article 22 declaration, and individuals can therefore present petitions in those countries. This represents only 35% of countries in Latin America. Here you have the names. And the impact of the presentation of petitions is as follows. Argentina, only 4 cases have been reported. In Ecuador, 1, and Venezuela, 1, giving a total amount of 6 cases. In the rest of the countries, this is the graphic. And this information was taken from a survey done by the UN Committee against Torture last November. So this is the information, the official information presented 3 months ago. And this leads us to ask us a question. Why should we go to the United Nations Committee on Torture in Latin America when we have an Inter-American system that has proven to be effective? And one of those questions have been debated today, and I will just mention one. The cases and the problems that are faced at the international level are different from the ones faced at the national level. So there can be good complementarity when working with both systems. And for a final thought, while representing victims in the Inter-American region, at the present moment, we recommend to go to the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Francisco. Our next speaker will be Julia Hall, please.
Well, thanks, Dean Grossman, for joining with Amnesty International to host this very timely meeting, and thanks as well to all of the people who organized and did the logistics. In terms of my own work in the national security and counterterrorism realm, the individual cases that I am going to discuss today, and there are two of them, one is called Atea v. Sweden, and the other is called Giza v. Sweden. They comprise an extremely small but vitally important subset of international jurisprudence that is crucial to the effort to seek accountability for human rights abuses committed in the context of the so-called war on terror. The Aegiza case in particular, I would argue, is a seminal case in terms of that type of accountability. In the interest of full disclosure, I was deeply, deeply involved in both cases, with counsel in both cases. And so when I talk about these cases, they're deeply personal to me, but it also means that you're getting really an insider's view of how some of these types of individual communications unfold, how advocacy organizations can have an impact on them. Just by way of a little bit of technical information, as Dean Grossman has noted, the vast majority of individual petitions involve Article 3 of the Convention. That is the non-refoulement obligation, the absolute prohibition against sending someone back via a variety of transfers, deportation, rendition, extradition, simple return expulsion, to a place where they would be at risk of torture. Specifically where there are substantial grounds for believing that he or she would be in danger of being subjected to torture. And important to look at that in light of General Comment 2, the newest of the comments that was adopted in 2007, because we can add to that, I think, in a more authoritative way, per Barbara's comments, that that absolute prohibition would, in fact, extend to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Of course, that's a very evidence-based test. It's important to go back to General Comment 1 by way of background. Unfortunately, it is woefully outdated and remains extremely vague, but we haven't heard these words yet today, so let me say them, okay? The author of the petition has to prove certain things, right? They have to prove that the risk of torture on return is not merely theoretical, right? Or that they suspect that they could be tortured. But they don't have to prove that it's highly probable that they'll be tortured. Now, there's a lot of room in between those two things. So in terms of evidence and standards, this is a very subjective process, I think. And that, in some cases, that is really helpful. In other cases, it's not. I would argue that in the Aegiza case, it was, in fact, it was helpful. Relevant information can be submitted by both the petitioner and the state party. And I would say that in the past, up until the very recent past, the state party has had, there's been an inequality of arms in terms of the provision of information. And I think that the committee has tended to rely more on the information from the state party. I do think that that is changing. The forms of evidence that can be submitted include a pattern of gross, flagrant, or mass violations of human rights, the past torture of a person, medical evidence of that past torture or ill treatment, changes on the ground since the person has been mistreated that would indicate that maybe now, at this point, they would be safer. And evidence as to the credibility of a person. Now, when you work in the national security and terrorism realm, credibility becomes quite an issue. We don't understand yet, or at least I don't understand yet, what types of factors the committee looks at when it comes to credibility. And this kind of greater clarity in terms of the credibility of the author would be very useful for us. Now, it's no secret that in terms of the non-refoulement obligation, it has taken quite a hit in the years comprising the global war on terror. As noted in previous presentations, persons have been unlawfully transferred from one country to another in the context of the U.S.-led rendition program, and national security suspects in Europe, Central Asia, the CIS, have been transferred to places where they have been at risk of torture. Undermining the non-refoulement obligation really can't be pinned on one country only. It has truly been a global hit job. However, in terms of the CAT's role in mediating this most recent damage to the principle, right, so let's just say since 9/11, it's a pair of cases that do deal with what the media call extraordinary rendition, what Amnesty International calls unlawful rendition, that have been the subjects of critically important individual petitions. The two cases, again, Atiyah v. Sweden and Aegiza v. Sweden, deal with the expulsion of two Egyptian asylum seekers from Sweden to Egypt in the context of the CIA-led rendition program. In order to understand the immense value of these cases, you must read them together. They cannot be read separately to actually pull the full value out of them. I would argue that the second case, Giza v. Sweden, is a correction to the first case, and that that correction contains a damning critique of renditions and of the types of the complex web of transfers that we saw during the Bush years. So maybe best to begin with the story. You know, what is the story of these victims of torture? On December 18, 2001, Ahmed Giza was at a bus stop and Mohammed Alzari was at school. They were apprehended in those separate locations by Swedish law enforcement officers. They were bundled into cars. They were mistreated in transit to Bromma Airport. When they arrived at Bromma Airport, their clothes were cut off. Jumpsuits were put on them. They were hooded, blindfolded. They claimed that there were suppositories that were inserted into their rectums. They were bundled onto a plane in the presence of U.S. security and intelligence agents who actually did the security check in Sweden. Right? The men had no recourse. At that point, they were then, of course, transferred onto Egypt, where both of them claimed that they had been tortured. The men had no recourse to a court or any proceeding allowing them to challenge their expulsions. Swedish law at the time permitted summary expulsions in national security cases. And here's the rub, and here's how Sweden justified these transfers on human rights grounds. Sweden claimed that they had gotten something called diplomatic assurances from the authorities in Cairo. These diplomatic assurances guaranteed that the men would not be tortured or ill-treated upon return, that they would not be subject to the death penalty, and that they would have access to fair trials. In Giza's case, it would be a retrial. He had been tried in absentia before. For those of you unfamiliar with diplomatic assurances, and I'm not sure there are many anymore because it's become something of a cottage industry in universities to research and analyze diplomatic assurances. These promises have been criticized up and down by not only advocacy organizations like Human Rights Watch, like Amnesty International, like the ICJ and the APT, who've actually joined a global coalition against their use, but in fact by many other organs of the United Nations, by the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, by the UN Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights in Counterterrorism, by the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. Okay, so there is broad criticism. And what does the criticism entail? I mean, if an official in Cairo said, we're not going to torture this guy, why can't you believe that? The damage to the standard comes from the fact that torture is routine in Egypt, and the Egyptian authorities routinely deny that torture occurs. The idea that you would trust the authorities in Cairo to keep safe these two men when, in fact, torture is endemic throughout the system is really, it's incredible in the most kind of generic sense of the word. But our critique goes beyond that. It goes really into the dynamics of torture. What is torture about? Some other speakers have said, you know, governments that practice torture deny it all the time, right? It's practiced in secret. In many countries, medical personnel are involved in the torture and ill-treatment of detainees. It leads to problems with detection. Detainees are afraid to talk about the abuse that they suffer because they're afraid of reprisals, etc. So I think built into the dynamics of torture is the critique of why these assurances actually cannot, as Louise Arbour has said so eloquently, they cannot work and they should not be used. In addition, and I think it's critical in terms of the CAT cases that I'll talk a little bit more about, there is absolutely no incentive on the part of either the sending government or the receiving government to acknowledge that there's been a breach of the assurances. The sending government would have to make an admission against its own interest that it had sent someone back to a place where they had, in fact, where that risk had actually been recognized. And the government, the receiving government, would have to acknowledge to some extent that they'd been responsible for an act of torture. So again, built into the very process that we're talking about is disincentive against accountability. Right? I would like to note as well that the Uber context for this is a 2005 speech by Condoleezza Rice, where she acknowledged on the eve of a trip to Europe that the United States government did in fact render people in this complex web of transfers, but that this, the fail-safe, the safeguard was that in every instance where there was a risk of torture or treatment, they got diplomatic assurances. All right, so it's quite the global lock in terms of justifying these transfers. Okay. I'd like to just quickly talk about the individual cases. The first case, Atiya v. Sweden, is Hanan Atiya and her five children, who she is Ahmed Agiza's wife. When Agiza was transferred, she went into hiding. Swedish human rights groups helped her go into hiding until she could lodge a petition with the Committee Against Torture. And she did that on December 28, 2001, 10 days after the transfer. On January 14th, the Committee Against Torture asked the Swedish government not to expel her until they had been able to review her case. Hanan Atiya argued that as the wife of a person who was a terrorism suspect and who had been tortured previously in Egypt, that she herself upon return would be subject to intimidation, harassment, ill treatment, and possibly torture herself. Now, it is not beyond the pale that the Egyptian authorities do threaten, intimidate, and torture family members. It's an unfortunate feature of the jurisprudence of the CAT at this point that the family link is considered too tenuous. And so at the end of the day, she lost on that marker. Her second argument was that the diplomatic assurances from the Egyptian government were unreliable, that in fact she had evidence that the Egyptian government could not be trusted to comply with the assurances. And as the case proceeded, she presented evidence that she thought was compelling that her husband had in fact been tortured and ill-treated upon arrival in Cairo. Based in large measure on information provided to the committee by the Swedish government, the committee ruled against Hanan Atiya. First, on the tenuous nature of her claim, because the relationship was to her husband, and they made the argument that she could not prove that she had that personal and present danger. But secondarily, and more importantly for our purposes today, the committee endorsed the notion that the Egyptians were complying with the assurances that they had given. And I want to emphasize that they endorsed that notion based largely on information from Sweden, which had conducted a series of monitoring visits to Ahmed Agiza in prison in Cairo. And so the committee said, in light of the passage of time, the committee is also satisfied by the provision of guarantees against abusive treatment, which also extend to the complainant, and are, in the present time, regularly monitored by the state party in situ. All right, so the committee said, we think the assurances are being observed, and we think that those assurances will extend to you, so we're going to rule against you. In the meantime, Ahmed Agiza's counsel lodges a petition with the committee in 2003. So his petition is now before the committee. Hanan Atiya's petition has been denied. Then I get a phone call. I get a phone call in the spring of 2004 from a Swedish journalist who says, I have a secret report from the Swedish government. Do you want to see it? It was all very cloak and dagger. And it was, in fact, cloak and dagger. So they sent to me a report. It was the first monitoring report that the Swedish government had written up after visiting Ahmed Agiza in prison 5 weeks after he was transferred. I got two copies. I got a redacted copy that was largely blacked out, and I got the leaked copy, which was the full text of the monitoring report. In that report, Ahmed Agiza claimed and told the Swedish monitors that he had been tortured and ill-treated, that he had been beaten, that he had been subject to electric shock, that he had been harassed, that he had been placed in a very small cell, that he had been deprived of sleep. There was a range of claims in terms of the ill treatment. So this was information that the Swedish government had not shared with the committee in its deliberations of Hanan Atiya. Those deliberations took place between 2001 and 2003. The report was from 2002. All right, so they failed to share that with the committee. When Ahmed Aghiz's claim came before the CAT, it was the first time anywhere in the world that extraordinary rendition was under a microscope. Nobody had looked at this. There was not one accountability process. And I want to congratulate both the committee and the High Commissioner's office for taking this case as seriously as they did. It is a 38-page decision. I think it is the longest decision that the CAT has ever written. And at the end of the day, the committee determined that that Sweden had violated the prohibition against sending someone back to a risk of torture. But what's interesting about that is that anyone who could have just looked at this case on its face could have determined that. Sending a person who's suspected of terrorist offenses back to Egypt at the time would have put him at risk, full stop. But the richness of the case comes in the committee's analysis of the interest of three separate security agencies, the Egyptians, the Swedes, and the Americans, colluding to send this person back to torture. Not only that, but the collusion of the Swedish government in terms of the cover-up of what they heard on the ground in Egypt. I think it made, when I read the decision, I sense a certain amount of anger on the part of the committee, that there was all sorts of machinations to ensure that the Swedish government could justify the return based on human rights grounds, and that the intelligence services could do the same based on the diplomatic assurances. I think that there are several different ways that we need to understand this case. First of all, at the time, it was the U.S. government and a few other governments who were engaged in using diplomatic assurances, the U.K., the U.S., Canada, in fact. In the intervening years, we have seen governments drop like dominoes. You know, it's not just the U.S. and Canada and the U.K., but Italy and Spain and Denmark has entertained the possibility, although they've not engaged in the practice, the Netherlands, Italy with returns to Tunisia, etc. This case stands as one of the few waxing too poetic, really stands as a cautionary tale against that practice. And you will see in cases all over Europe now where domestic courts are determining whether a government can send people back. You see Aghiz v. Sweden cited in every last one of them. And so in my mind, I'm sorry that the committee initially ruled against Hanan Atiya, because it struck me that, you know, the return on its face deserved more deliberation in terms of an Article 3 violation. I was glad to see Aghiz v. Sweden, and I think that this case stands virtually alone at this point, with the exception of a few prosecutions of American intelligence agents in Italy that happened at the end of last year. It stands alone as an accountability mechanism for one of the most horrendous abuses that occurred during the war on terror, and that is rendition to torture and ill treatment. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Julia. Our next speaker is Anne Jordan.
Thank you. First, I'd like to start by thanking Dean Grossman, the Washington College of Law, and Amnesty International for hosting this event, and also for asking me to participate and take me a little bit out of my safe zone of working on human trafficking and forced labor to think about this issue in a somewhat different light. Although the connection between human trafficking, forced labor, and torture may not seem obvious at first, I wish to explore this possible connection, and I look forward to the responses from the experts who are here today. I'm going to talk about the question of who can make a complaint to the committee, who qualifies as a victim of torture. So I'd first like to start out by introducing three typical victims of trafficking and forced labor. Ismelda, Monica, and Julio decided to go abroad for work, and Ismelda planned to work in the house of a diplomat. Monica traveled with her new husband, and Julio planned to work in construction. However, once in the diplomat's home, Ismelda found herself in a living hell. She was forced to wake up every morning at 5 and work until midnight. She washed, cleaned, cooked, took care of the children, and was never paid. She slept on a thin mat in the basement of the house and was never allowed outside except when they sent her out to get the mail. She learned quickly to keep quiet and not complain, because if she did, the missus would beat her with a stick and often made her kneel on a ruler on the floor for a long time as punishment. The family also threatened to throw her out in the street and to punish her family back home for any infraction, which they could well do since they were diplomats and had high status back home. She was only allowed to eat the scraps left over from the family's table, so she never knew if she was going to have enough to eat. She's also not allowed to see a doctor, not even when she had a visible tumor in her stomach the size of a pumpkin, and her teeth were decaying. Ismelda finally got away when a neighbor saw her at the mailbox and asked her about the tumor and helped her escape with the clothes on her back. Monica had fallen in love with a man that she did not know was from a family of traffickers. After marriage and the birth of the child, the family took the baby, and then they forced Monica into prostitution in the capital of her country, where she was held captive and raped repeatedly until she lost all hope. Many women were in her situation under the control of husbands who had many wives in forced prostitution, and they who operated with the full knowledge of the entire community and the law enforcement officials. Once she was broken in, Monica was sent to another country where she was circulated among the brothels. She was forced to live in deplorable conditions, kept away from outsiders, never able to learn the local language, and was physically punished. Once they broke a bottle over her head and threatened to cut her with it. However, the fact that her baby was being held by the traffickers kept her very compliant, listless, and hopeless. Monica finally escaped when the police raided the brothel. However, she still does not have her child, and it is not safe for her to return home. Julio paid a smuggler to take him abroad to work on a farm. However, once across the border, he and the other men were taken to an isolated farm where they were forced at gunpoint to work long hours at no pay, beaten for infractions, and knew that their families were being threatened back home. One of the men was killed trying to escape. Now, these are very typical stories of trafficking victims all over the world. If these victims had been trafficked into the United States, they would have actually been fairly lucky because they would have been offered temporary residence, work permits, and support. They would probably be able to obtain permanent residence eventually, and their traffickers would be put in prison, and they would be able to get on with their lives. However, unfortunately, most countries do not have such legal protections. Instead, the most common response of governments around the world is simply to deport the victims back to their home countries. So they need another source of protection. So the question I want to open for discussion is whether some victims of trafficking would qualify as victims of torture to satisfy the non-refoulement principle under the Torture Convention. Torture can be linked to trafficking in at least two ways. In one, state-sponsored torture compels a person to emigrate under dangerous conditions. And, of course, they would have to use some sort of intermediary to escape, and they may end up being trafficked into forced labor. This person would be able to seek asylum. However, the second situation involves the use by traffickers of force, threats, and psychological coercion in the process by which they reduce their victims to compliant, supple workers. In this case, the question is whether a trafficked person in danger of being deported back into the world of traffickers can meet the criteria as a victim of torture. There's been very little written about this question, and even less, practically no discussion among anti-trafficking experts on this issue. So while I'm not an expert on the Torture Convention, I will attempt to open this discussion on this tantalizing possibility. The first question to be addressed is whether the victims of trafficking are also victims of torture. The torture provisions of the ICCPR and the European Convention don't define torture, but the Torture Convention defines it as severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, that is intentionally inflicted on a person. Is there any similarity between the pain and suffering of torture victims and trafficking victims? The methods used by traffickers are remarkably similar to those used by by torturers are remarkably similar to those used by traffickers. Violence, isolation, unpredictability, deprivation of food and sleep, forced medications, forced abortions, and being paraded around naked. As one counselor in Australia said, women I see have histories of torture or sex trafficking, and they tell me stories that contain similar features. They do not know where they're being taken, where they were trapped. Their families had no idea of their whereabouts. No one could help them or save them. The violence and persecution was unpredictable, and this was part of the perpetrator's power over them. Fear of what might happen next was almost worse than knowing the violence had started. The use of rape, beatings, humiliation, deprivation, and witnessing the torture of others was disclosed. These women presented with headaches. Most had had their heads targeted in the violent assaults. Instruments of the state, such as police and government officials, were used to harm these women in some cases, and at best colluded with or turned a blind eye to the violence. Post-traumatic stress is common among all victims of trafficking, and in some instances it can go on for years and years. They suffer from emotional instability and unable to hold a job, unable to connect with other human beings because they've learned over the process not to trust anyone, and they need long-term care. So I would argue then that victims of torture and victims of trafficking similarly suffer severe pain or suffering. The next criteria under the Torture Convention is the requirement that there must be a purpose of these acts. The ICCPR and the European Convention do not explicitly require a purpose for the infliction of severe pain or suffering, while the Torture Convention requires a purpose of, quote, obtaining from him, the victim, or a third person, information or a confession, punishing him for an act he or a third person committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating him or coercing him or a third person for any reason based on discrimination of any kind. So I would say that the objective of the torturer and the trafficker is basically to use pain and suffering to punish victims for refusal to comply with requests and to force them into compliance, and to create a psychological effect on the victim that results in the total subjugation of the will and a helplessness to escape, and to break them physically and psychologically so they will eventually come to accept as inevitable the outcome that the trafficker or the torturer wants. So here again, I would argue that the traffickers and torturers use same or similar techniques to achieve the same purpose, which is the total control of the victim. Now, the difficulty with the trafficking as torture argument under the Torture Convention arises in the third element, which limits the category of persons who are responsible for inflicting the torture. The Torture Convention requires a link between the infliction of severe pain or suffering and the state. However, the ICCPR and the European Convention are silent as to whether the actor must be a state or it can also be a non-state party. In HLRV France, the European Court stated that non-state actors can commit torture in the context of a state's obligation of non-refoulement. Although in that case there was insufficient evidence of torture, the case provides protection to a person in Europe who can prove there is a real risk of being subjected to torture or inhuman or degrading treatment by a non-state actor. Interestingly, for people working on human trafficking, that case involved a drug trafficker who claimed he would be tortured by the trafficking network back home, which the court would have accepted if he had provided sufficient proof of this risk of torture. So trafficking cases are very similar, and I would hold that people who wanted to bring a case in Europe would be able to benefit from this holding. On the other hand, in General Comment 20, the Human Rights Committee has recognized that states have an obligation to protect people from torture from non-state parties. They held, it is the duty of the state party to afford everyone protection through legislation and other measures as may be necessary against the acts prohibited by Article 7, whether inflicted by people acting in their official capacity, outside their official capacity, or in a private capacity. Now, although this refers to acts within the territory of the state, the same reasoning would support the responsibility of states under the ICCPR to protect people from being returned home to face torture in the hand of non-state actors. However, under the Torture Convention, the state must be involved. The act must be inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or any other person acting in an official capacity. So it's a much stronger requirement. While I recognize it is extremely difficult under the Torture Convention to find that acts by non-state actors would qualify, since the Committee Against Torture has restricted such actors to de facto regimes that exercise certain prerogatives that are comparable to those normally exercised by legitimate governments. Although the perpetrators of trafficking can be organized gangs that control large numbers of people and may even control territory through violence and payments to local leaders and are able to operate with impunity for years, I do not believe that the typical trafficking networks or gangs are de facto regimes by any stretch of the imagination. They are not armed groups seeking political power. They are simply armed groups seeking to control a base for their criminal activities. However, is it possible to argue that traffickers operate with the consent or acquiescence of public officials? In the majority of trafficking cases, corrupt public officials are involved in illegal border crossings, in issuing bogus documents, in protecting safe houses en route, in protecting the brothels and factories in which trafficked persons are held, and even in ensuring that trafficked persons who are escaped are returned to their traffickers. Public officials are known to engage in violence and rape of victims, and generally to contribute to an atmosphere of fear and hopelessness among victims who know they have no option but to submit to the demands of their traffickers. Officials who collaborate with traffickers and have knowledge of the tactics being used by the traffickers to control, punish, and intimidate victims into obedience and submission are, I would argue, clearly acquiescing in the torture being inflicted by the traffickers. This would implicate the state directly in the torture of the victims, and I believe could support a claim under the Torture Convention. So I will end as I began with a question. Are there any circumstances under which a victim of trafficking, the types of scenarios I've discussed, could produce sufficient evidence of acts by a non-state actor carried out with the consent or acquiescence of state officials to satisfy the requirements of the Torture Convention? In other words, is there any means by which the Torture Convention can provide succor and safe harbor to victims of human trafficking, such as Imelda, Monica, and Julio, who may be deported to a country in which they could be tortured, re-trafficked, and even killed by criminal gangs? I look forward to hearing your responses to this question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We began a little later than the hour that had been programmed, and we have a question and answer period, a very limited one, I may say, because we're ending the session in the afternoon. I have approximately 15 minutes, I think, to concede on questions, so I'd like to ask for the floor anyone who would like to ask the panel for a question or an opinion on what has just been said by this very brilliant panel, which has talked about a number of issues, I think, of enormous relevance and importance to the Convention and to the Article 22 as we have seen it. Yes, please. Can you identify yourself and direct the question to the panelists you think is, or to the members of the panel?
This working now? Mm-hmm. Okay. I've been identifying myself all day, but I'm Yuval Ginbar from Amnesty. I want to express some thoughts about the last question we've been asked. It could be dangerous to extend the concept of torture to everything happening between private people. Torture in the CATS state is a human rights violation, and there has to be state involvement, and that makes sense. If we extend it too much, any burglary, any crime can be a human rights violation because the state does not prevent it or punish it. However, so I wouldn't call trafficking as a phenomenon an act of torture. But in the case of what happens within one state, to the extent that traffickers are involved, you would have to show official involvement in every single case, I would suggest. However, in the case of refoulement, oddly enough, as far as I understand it, the act of official acquiescence would be the act of taking the person from an environment safe from abuse and returning her to a place where there is more than likely or high likelihood of her being abused. In other words, the act of acquiescence is the act of refoulement itself, or it could so be argued. Thank you.
Yes?
No, that's okay.
Please.
Human Rights USA here, and I wanted to respond to Ms. Jordan's question. We actually have been representing survivors of trafficking in asylum cases here in the United States on the same framework that you put forward. At the same time, I having been able to fit them into the refugee context, I very much want to hear what people say about fitting it under the definition of torture because of that governmental involvement, but just wanted to respond to that we have been quite successful in securing asylum for people who are trafficked.
Claudio?
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on Francisco's evaluation where to go to CAT or to the Inter-American Commission. I agree with you due to many reasons. Let me mention something. Why to go to the Inter-American Commission? First of all, on the substantive analysis of rights, the Commission and the Court have developed a rich jurisprudence on the process, habeas corpus, and that's directly related with torture. For example, if there is a claim involving non-refoulement under the Inter-American system, because the prohibition against torture and other forms of cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment and punishment is absolute, cannot be derogated, and there are decisions, advisory opinions. I will not bother anyone with legalese here. You know, it's obvious that it's better to go to the Inter-American system in this type of case. I mean, on the substantive development of rights. I will tell you, I think that if any, with my knowledge in the Inter-American system, after 8 years there and having taken a lot of cases in the court also, if somebody were to go to the Inter-American system and say, independently we came to a conclusion that sending a person to a country where there is a risk for torture or inhumane treatment, that would be lowered by diplomatic assurances, I think they would laugh on that. I mean, in other words, through diplomatic assurances, this type of risk will disappear. What diplomatic assurances can you give when you have a Pinochet? You know, a Videla. I mean, they bring your mother and they say, you know, when the Europeans leave, you know, or the US, when they leave, they bring your mother and say, you know, we'll bring your mom if you don't do this. And also, people cannot claim they don't know what everyone knows. In this realm, I mean, diplomatic assurances were used as a way to send people to countries where they could be tortured with some cover-up. I mean, that's the story. That's the case. A little bit of protection, you know. And again, that could be a diplomatic assurance that you're not going to be the object of the death penalty. That way, they have been used sometimes. Yeah. But in the, we have seen the popularization of the diplomatic assurance in this context. I mean, so first of all, substantively, no doubt that the countries that are in the American system should go there. Second thing, procedural, no doubt. You know, it's an elaborate legal system with a framework of, you know, burden of proof, standards of proof, assessment of fact, hearings, you know, possibility of cross-examining people. The CAT procedure is in writing. And there is no framework of reference as to how do I how you analyze facts, how do you evaluate? That's why you see contradictions. And most of the jurisprudence also relates to Article 3, where the going interpretation is that only torture is a reason not to send people. Yeah, so procedurally also, you know, the ability to have open hearings, publicized, you know, that in the internet now you can mobilize, you know. Second reason, reparation. Very insufficient development of reparation in CAT. You know, the Inter-American system has the most developed. I'm adding to your very excellent contribution. Composition of the secretariat. Everyone is great in the United Nations, that's not the point. But you have a body of 27 full-time lawyers in the commission. You know, and a tradition that is a legal tradition, the members of the court are, I mean, there are, listen, there are three, four reasons why that's the case. However, I think that there are situations where the CAT needs to be preferred in a trial, in an impact litigation strategy. For example, we just have seen the reaction of Venezuela concerning a report by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. You know, if from the point of view of a legal political strategy, you know, I'm not talking as an individual that is a lawyer advising one client, but an NGO that has a trial strategy of impact litigation might prefer CAT in a given moment because of the political context that is taking place with the commission. So I would add that for the analysis. There is another thing. Good lawyering can shape also CAT. And I think this is, well, perhaps it's the messianic approach, but I think that the quality of lawyering, this, you know, the Inter-American system also was the result of good lawyering to a great extent. The convention did not say anything about burden of proof, assessment of facts, did not say anything about the participation of the lawyers in proceedings, you know, before the court. And good lawyering make a difference. So I think for institutions like CEGIL, broadening the regional scope to the universal scope from the point of view of a strategy of impact litigation would be very important. Once, because some countries are saying bad news for the system, and second thing, because you can shape also universal institutions through to a creative lawyer. So that's why I think that in an assessment of it, this is more a comment, Francisco, and already a lengthy one, but I think that just saying we don't go to CAT, no. I think that there must be conditions, and also, finally, the experience of Latin American NGOs is great. The declaration of the Latin American countries under Article 22 is relatively recent. Chile, a year ago, perhaps. Argentina, what, 3 years, 2 years? So that's why it's not known. But you can play a role in spreading the word. The same Venezuela, it has been a bit later, but I think that it could add value in a strategy of implementation. So that's what I wanted to comment. Thank you very much.
We're very lucky to have Nora also as a member of the committee comment on this, on issues.
Thank you. Well, I'm Nora Sveos. I'm a member of the committee, and I want to make some comments to the very, very important question that was raised by Anne Jordan on trafficking. And in fact, the Committee Against Torture has for some years now seen trafficking under the purview of the convention. It has been raised questions in relation to that, but it has been our very firm conviction. I also would like to quote the former chair of the committee, who said that trafficking perhaps is the worst kind of torture. So I think that's an interesting part. As for the Article 1 and the definition, there is no discussion whatsoever as to the infliction of pain psychologically and physically. And then under the state involvement, the argument has been lack of due diligence and lack of protection of people. So it has also come up very frequently under Article 2 on issues of prevention and also legal measures. So the question will very often be to state parties as to what legal provisions are in place in order to stop or in some way prevent trafficking from happening, and also considering well, I'll come back to that. It's also raised, I'm not aware of having any direct questions as to this under Article 3, and it was discussed before also, but definitely under training, the importance of training police personnel and others, also border people, to be aware of the issue of trafficking, because we see very often in the reports, especially from advocacy groups, how the lack of good border control also can be, or the not acknowledging this as a problem can also make it happen. So under 10 it definitely comes up, including in the necessity of training police officers to understand what violence against women is all about. And then it's under Article 12, investigation, and the need and the obligation of state party to investigate when allegations of trafficking is up, and also reparations. And we have frequently asked about programs of reparation, rehabilitation, safe houses, shelters, on these issues. I would like to mention, for instance, one safe party that we asked about, particularly about statistics on ongoing investigations on trafficking. And the reply was that they had ongoing, I think, 7,000 different investigations. And when the question came to how many had been sentenced as responsible for trafficking, the answer was zero. So there were lots of investigations, but no punishment, no reparations, no direct actions as to protect the people involved. And finally, of course, under 16, we're talking also about cruel and inhuman degrading treatment and punishment. So I would say that most of the convention is used and will be used and has been used on this issue. So thank you very much for raising it.
Thank you. Can I just ask you a question then? Is it my understanding what you're saying is that then that there has not been a case where Article 3 has been used, where somebody has tried to use Article 3 to prevent being deported as a victim of trafficking?
No. We have tried to think about it and go back in the memory, but unfortunately I didn't bring my laptop, so I couldn't do a brief. So I don't think we have dealt with it in CAT, but I want to say, because I'm from Norway, and we have had some cases in Norway, mm-hmm. where we've had, it has been almost easier to have women not being for reasons of being tortured than other more ordinary refugees. So that had been some cases now, at least in Norway.
But I
must look to see, and I cannot remember for the 4 years I've been in the committee that we've had any cases on trafficking particularly. And we have not received, to my knowledge, any individual complaints either.
Uh-huh. Okay. If you find any, let me know.
Yes,
thanks.
Well, I thank you very much. I'd just like to make a comment, and I think it was a very interesting panel and very, very constructive participation of every one of the members. Undoubtedly, we have covered an enormous space of doctrine and of the working of the committee. I think each one has contributed an insight into very complicated matters of legal finesse, but also of human importance. Let me tell you that each one of you has touched on issues very, very dear to all of us members of the committee and to any human being. I think it's been an enormous experience and a worthwhile one. On the issue of trafficking, let me just end by a reference to a country that we were talking on the issue of trafficking, which we have tried to bring into each one of the country reports. And to my enormous surprise, this country reported to us that it had tabulated 1 million people under trafficking. So we're not talking about the two or three issues of the case. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of people under the doctrine. In that sense, I would also like to contribute by saying that comment number 2 of the committee equates inhuman, cruel, and degrading treatment to torture. So I think in the procedure in the future, we should look more into that aspect of it, not necessarily as a definition alone on Article 1. And I would like to thank you and thank Dean Grossman, and thank all of you for having this wonderful event that will contribute to the issue of a better knowledge of this enormous and challenging issue in our day. Thank you very much.